everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. This episode, I'm going to be talking about the DC Rebirth titles that came out on Wednesday, October 19th. Normally, Manny joins me on these episodes. Very sad to say that he is feeling under the weather. He basically can't get a single sentence out without hacking his lungs up, basically just coughing his head off. So he decided to sit this one out. Apologize for that. Usually he joins me, gives a bit more of perspective, different viewpoints on the books. So running solo tonight. Again, my apologies. It should go pretty quick. So it'd be a short episode for you with just me talking about the books. So without further ado, let me dive right into it.
Please do note, this is no ordinary comic book. It is in permanent condition. If you spill soda on it, the drops fly off harmlessly onto lesser comics.
Oh.
Yes, you are quite correct to gasp.
All right, so the first book I'm going to talk about is Aquaman number 9, written by Dan Abnett, pencils by Scott Eaton, inks are by Wayne Fokker, and colors by Gabe Eltab. So this continues the story from Aquaman 8 with Shaggy Man basically heading for Amnesty Bay, which is, of course, Aquaman's hometown on the surface. And the basically the line that the Shaggy Man is taking, he was imprisoned in the ocean floor somehow, some crevice in the ocean, whatever. Black Manta's Nemo organization resurrects him, sends him to Amnesty Bay, and it just so happens that he's got to walk straight through Atlantis to get to it, so it's kind of like two birds with one stone. So the issue is a lot of action. It's basically Aquaman doing everything he can to try to stop the Shaggy Man. Because, as I said, at the end of issue 8, they realized that Atlantis wasn't the target, but Amnesty Bay was. But, of course, Aquaman, and again, this is Abnett doing an incredible job of showing that Aquaman is really a character and a person who's torn between these two worlds. So just as much as he wants to protect Atlantis, he wants to protect Amnesty Bay. But one thing we learn in the story is that he wants to do it. He wants it. He doesn't want to just call in the Justice League. He wants to do it. So, you know, a few issues ago, we saw Aquaman confronting Superman, and Superman basically saying, you need to take care of these things. You need to take care of these things. It can't be us stepping in. And I think that's basically what Aquaman is doing at this point. He's trying to prove himself in the eyes of the world. If I have a complaint about the issue, it would be in the way that the conflict was resolved. It wasn't exactly a deus ex machina, but it was close. It just seemed kind of obvious, you know, if that's what Aquaman was going to do, he could have done it a lot sooner. But it was interesting because even in the midst of this issue, which is almost all action, Abnett manages to put a little hook in there that's all character. Really gets to the heart of what's troubling Arthur Curry Aquaman at this point, of kind of the conflict of character that he has. And that's reflected both in the fact that this Shaggy Man monster destroyed parts of Atlantis in this issue, as well as damaged Aquaman's home on the surface. So it's continuing that theme that of him being torn between two things, of him being, should he be calling the Justice League to help him handle these threats? Should he be handling them on his own? Is his number one priority Atlantis? Is his number one priority the surface world? And it just goes to show that Abnett's a great writer, even though he's writing about a superhero here, being pulled in different directions with different responsibilities is something that I think a lot of people can relate to. You know, you have your responsibilities at your job, and how do you weigh that against your responsibilities as a parent, for example, or a spouse? You know, you have to work extra, but then you're neglecting your kids at home, and you know, we've all experienced it in different ways. And so I really love how Abnett is keeping that a central theme, and it's definitely still a political book. You know, we see got a little bit of Mira and the people that she is with. I can't remember what they're called off the top of my head. But basically the priestesses, I guess you'd say, that just kind of hold the history of Atlantis, that she has to prove that she is worthy of marrying Arthur Curry Aquaman. So we got a little bit of that in the story as well. And there definitely seems to be more to them than meets the eye. But I guess it didn't bother me as much in this issue as it did in the last issue, that, you know, because I mentioned that last issue, how she just kind of, you know, she hears the sirens go off, she hears the screams and the fighting or whatever, but she stays where she is, and I just thought that was strange. I feel like she should have just been like, they're called the Widowhood. She's at the Tower of the Widowhood in Atlantis. So, I don't know, it just didn't sit well with me last issue. This issue, it felt like less, I don't know, less of a big deal, I guess you'd say. Maybe because I found out that the Atlantis itself wasn't the end-all, be-all destination for the Shaggy Monster. So, I don't know. It's definitely an interesting subplot that's playing, and it feels like Abnett's playing the long game here. So, all in all, a solid issue of Aquaman. The art, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, I prefer Brad Walker's art. I like when Brad does the interiors. It's not to say Scott Eaton's art is bad. I just feel like his storytelling from panel to panel isn't as strong as Brad Walker's. But as far as the rendering, you know, it's solid. It's good, solid comic book art. That's what I'll say about it. You know, it's not groundbreaking. There are a few panels that are really awesome. The panel where Shaggy Man jumps out of the water finally and lands in Amnesty Bay is a particularly good panel. He does a good job. I mean, I think his rendering on Shaggy Man is probably my favorite. He draws Shaggy Man better than anyone else in the book, really. So, like I said, good, solid comic book art. Nothing spectacular, but certainly gets the job done. All right, next up we have Batman number 9, written by Tom King. Pencils and inks by Mikel Yanin. Colors by June Chung. So this is the first installment, I guess you'd say, the first part of the I Am Suicide Squad story that's going to take place over the next few issues of Batman and probably lead into the Justice League versus Suicide Squad crossover that I talked about in the New York Comic Con wrap-up. So it's basically Gotham Girl is still hurting from what Psycho Pirate did to her under the orders of Hugo Strange. And in order to reverse the effects, Batman needs Psycho Pirate. But Psycho Pirate is in the hands of Bane in Santa Prisca. And so Batman decides, you know, we saw at the end of that first arc before the Night of the Monster Man interlude that Amanda Waller basically gave Batman a proposition to go into Santa Prisca and extract Psycho Pirate. I imagine he initially turned it down. That's what it seems like from reading the beginning of this issue. And then in this issue, we see him change his mind. He can't bear to see Gotham Girl struggle. So this issue is really interesting. And Tom King was saying, the writer was saying on Twitter, that really it's the start of three storylines. There's a lot hidden in it, and you need to read it multiple times. So it's probably on the surface the I Am Suicide Squad part one story. There's also, I'm not going to spoil who shows up at the very end, but that could be something else, the start of another relationship for Batman, or the return of a relationship for him. And we also actually see Saturn Girl. That's a bit of a spoiler, but I'm just going to say that because that'll give you a chance to look for her in the issue itself and find out where she is, because it's not obvious. And I didn't notice it the first time I read it myself. So, but that can certainly be the start of something, maybe the first step on a return of the Legion of Superheroes in the DC universe. So it's a real well-crafted story. I think Tom King is doing a masterful job on Batman. I have been looking forward to seeing Mikel Yanin's pencils on this, his art. I loved what he did with Grayson. I couldn't wait to see his take on Batman. I will say that his art here is a little different. It's much more, it's not as clean, it's not as slick looking as it looked in Grayson, and that's fine. It suits this book very well, being that it's set in Gotham City. You know, it should be a little darker, it should be a little dirtier, a little, you know, less slick, a little less clean looking, and so I wasn't let down by the art at all. There's some really excellent facial expressions. There's some really nice compositions within the panels themselves. So I really, really love the art. I'm looking forward to seeing more from Mikhail Yanin, where he has a little more room to breathe. I mean, the majority of the issue takes place in Arkham Asylum as Batman's kind of putting his own private suicide squad together. And so he's kind of confined and limited in what he can do as far as space and color. But, I mean, it works well because you definitely get that claustrophobic feeling of being in prison. So, really, really great issue. Like I said, I think Tom King is killing it. I think I prefer his writing on Batman to Scott Snyder. I know that's sacrilege to some people, but I just love Tom King's take on Batman. He seems so much less self-aware or self-referential, I guess you'd say. And by that, I mean, a little bit in a way, whenever I read or was reading a Scott Snyder Batman book, I was aware that I was reading a Scott Snyder Batman book. And it felt like, in a way, Bruce Wayne, the character, was aware that I was reading about him in a Batman Scott Snyder book, if that makes any sense. Whereas when I read a Tom King Batman story, it's just a Batman story. It just, I don't know, there's some kind of, I don't even know how to explain it, just some kind of intangible with Tom King's stories where they just seem a little more natural. They seem like I have a window into Batman's world and I'm just watching it. Whereas in a way, when I read the Scott Snyder books, it's almost like Scott Snyder saying, okay, well, I know this Batman story here, let me tell you. You know, it feels like it's third party a little bit. You know, it's Scott Snyder relating what happened to Batman. Whereas to the Tom King books, I just feel like I'm watching it happen. I don't know if any of that makes any sense or if I'm just really tired. But I don't know. It's a difference that's tangible for me. And I'm really, really enjoying what Tom King is doing on the book. So, this, if you haven't been following Batman, if you haven't been reading, I think this is an excellent time to jump on. You don't really need to understand anything that's happened before. You can jump right on with issue 9, hit the ground running, and I can't wait to see Batman go into Santa Prisca and face off against Bane. Really, really looking forward to that. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is Cyborg number 3. This issue was written by John Semper Jr., pencils and inks by Will Conrad, Ivan Nunez on colors. So this is probably the most action-packed issue of Cyborg to this point. The issue that's had the most fighting pages, fighting panels on it so far. Now the fact that some of these fights may or may not be real, some of it's flashbacks, some of it's memory, some of it's just dreams, it's neither here nor there. The fact is, this is the most action-packed issue so far, but it really deepens the mystery, and I feel like that's what this issue was meant to do. It really meant to deepen the mystery into who exactly is this villain that Cyborg is going up against. So we don't get a lot of character development for Cyborg like we have in the past couple issues, which in a way was a disappointment. Because I love the issues where they really focus on Victor Stone and who he is as a character. But we do see him do some cool things, some things that certainly are unexpected. And I think in a way, you know, it might be further down the line when we look back on this issue and go, oh, look, see where Semper was like sowing the seeds for this or that. So still a solid issue. certainly not my favorite issue of Cyborg so far. Like I said, because there's not, it's a lot of setup. It's one of those things where, and you know, I talk about this a lot on the show with story beats, and this is just one of those beats where it needs to be down a little, because the probably the next issue it's going to shoot way back up. So still a quality book. I've heard the numbers on Cyborg are not really, really great, which is a shame, because it's an excellent book. And that's really a shame, because with the movie coming up, I feel like this is a book that a lot of people should be reading. The art by Will Conrad is excellent. Great facial expressions. Great compositions within the panels. Really impactful. There's one where Victor slams his fist down the table and says, "Immediately!" It's just so well done. Facial expressions, storytelling, as I said. Really, really great use of color, especially to differentiate between what parts of the story may or may not be happening in real time. So that was really done well. So yeah, just a gorgeous, gorgeous book. You know, I've mentioned before, the colorist, I don't know if this is the same colorist, Yvonne Nunez. I don't think it is, but the coloring in this book is absolutely outstanding. Just subtle shifts in the settings that really help differentiate the book. So yeah, Cyborg continues to be excellent. I think if you're not reading it, like I said, only 3 issues are out, so it'd be pretty easy to get caught up. I definitely recommend it. Next up, we have Green Arrow number 9, written by Ben Percy and art by Stephen Byrne. That is both rendering and colors. So this is Island of Scars part 2. We saw that Diggle, Oliver Queen, and Black Canary all washed up on an island at the beginning of the last issue. And this part 2 is basically the story of their escape from that island. And what struck me the most was that it wasn't pretty. It was very messy. It didn't go exactly like they would have wanted it to. It didn't go exactly as they planned. And in that way, I feel like Ben Percy's giving us a hint of what's to come. The end results are ultimately what matters. But how you get there is the difference between being a much beloved Superman-like superhero who's, you know, fights during the day and has their pictures in the paper and is seen as just this paragon of superhuman virtue. Whereas the guys that are down on the street, you know, getting their hands dirty, fighting the fights where the lines aren't so clearly delineated between what's right and what's wrong. And those kind of stories are some of the best Green Arrow stories that have ever been told. I'm specifically thinking of the Mike Carell era of Green Arrow. And it seems like that's where Ben Percy is taking this version of the Green Arrow, with Black Canary along for the ride and Diggle as well. So I'm definitely in. Again, this is such a quality book. It's a book that I have to read as soon as it comes out, as soon as it's available. I have to dig in and read it, you know, as soon as possible, because it's so, so good. It's so compelling. I love the characterization. I love the relationship that Percy's developing between Oliver Queen and Dinah Lance. It's just outstanding. And you know, I'm so happy they brought Stephen Byrne on as another artist on the series to join Otto Schmidt and Juan Ferreira. His art is gorgeous. I love the colors. I love the rendering. I love the fact that each of these artists on the book are kind of a one-stop shop for that particular issue, because from the original pencil lines to the inking to the colors, it's hopefully their vision on the page. And they're all great storytellers. They're all great at coloring and the expression. And yeah, I cannot say, I mean, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Green Arrow's the best book, the best DC Rebirth book. It is just so, so good. If you're only reading one DC Rebirth book, Green Arrow should be it. And that's such a huge surprise to me. You know, I expected Wonder Woman to be great, and it is. It's probably the second best title. You know, right there neck and neck with Green Arrow. Maybe sometimes it might overtake here or there, but I expected that from Wonder Woman based on the creative team. I certainly didn't expect to enjoy Green Arrow as much as I am. I didn't expect it to be their best book, but it is so, so, so good. All right, next I'm going to talk about Nightwing number 7. This is Rise of the Raptor Part 1, written by Tim Seeley, art by Javier Fernandez, and colors by Chris Sotomayor. So, Manny and I both weren't real happy with the interlude of Night of the Monster Men. We just kind of felt like it was a little bit ho-hum. I personally, as far as the Nightwing book was concerned, couldn't wait for us to get back to regular stories because I wanted to see more Raptor. And now that I have, you know the expression, be careful what you wish for? Because I loved Raptor as a character up until this point. But this issue, he just does some things that I just don't care for. And, you know, I understand that I thought I'm a hero, or at least someone who was willing to get the job done, the job that needed doing. But, you know, the way he's portrayed by Tim Seeley in this issue, he's much more unlikable. At this moment in time, I like him much less than I did. But that's a sign of a great writer, the fact that I said I was out on Nightwing, but he used a character like Raptor to suck me back in, and now I'm finding out there's even more depth to the character than I first thought, because he's willing to betray Dick Grayson. He's turns out he has history with Dick Grayson's family. It's very intriguing. I can't wait to find out more about who exactly Raptor is. So very much looking forward to that, even though I don't exactly like the things that Raptor did in this issue. But again, it's I said he was one of the most complex characters that's been introduced in the DC universe in a really, really long time, and Seeley is just proving that. So despite my previous declaration of being out on Nightwing, man, I am still in. And despite me disliking Raptor, the things Raptor did in this issue, I'm still in because I'm intrigued and I have to know who he is. All right, up next we have Raven number 2, written by Marv Wolfman, art by Allison Borges, The Fear Within Part 2. I liked this issue much less than issue 1. I felt like this issue was a little harder to get into. It may be that if I went back and pulled out issue 1 and read that first, that it would flow kind of seamlessly into this one. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. The art does seem a little bit more moody than the first issue. The colors particularly seem to be a bit more muted. I do love the rendering in the art as far as what Raven's astral projection looks like. Keeps some continuity with this version of Raven versus her new 52 version. So I want to know what the mystery is, the mystery that Raven's trying to solve. So it's compelling in that way. And I'm a big Marv Wolfman fan, so I like what they're doing so far. I think there's a lot of room for improvement, and this may be one where it's reads better in a trade. I'm not sure, but I'm gonna keep getting the individual issues for now. But yeah, again, a good solid comic story with good solid comic art. Not groundbreaking, but certainly spectacular in scope. And I look forward to reading more of Raven in a team setting after this, because I want to see how the events of this miniseries, which are some of the circumstances are new as they pertain to Raven. So I'll be interesting to see how it affects her in a team setting going forward. All right, next up we have Suicide Squad Most Wanted, El Diablo, and Killer Croc, number 3. So again, I feel like this is one of those books where they're trying to capitalize on the popularity of the Suicide Squad. If that's what they're doing, and that's the reason this book exists, then kudos to them. Let me just say that the creative team for the first part of the book, the El Diablo part, is written by Jay Nitz. Art by Cliff Richards and colors by Hi-Fi Design. Never been a big El Diablo fan. Don't know that anybody was. But man, Nitz is doing an incredible job of making him relatable, making him realistic. I definitely understand the demons that El Diablo has and the burdens that he has to carry around. And Nitz has done a masterful job of kind of explaining why El Diablo is the way that he is. And I'm sure this is a book that's not blowing up any records as far as sales go. You know, even the title itself, Suicide Squad Most Wanted, El Diablo, Killer Croc, is a mouthful to say. But I hope that it's getting enough buzz that people are interested in picking it up, because the book is excellent. It is just, I love the dialogue especially. It's done really, really, really well. And yeah, this is, I'm quickly becoming an El Diablo. Like, if El Diablo was written this way, the way he's been in the series all the time, then I would buy every El Diablo comic that came out, because it's just that good. Like, the character work in the story is just that amazing. So the second part of the book is about Killer Croc. I didn't enjoy that half of the story as much. I don't know if that's because I have even less familiarity with Killer Croc than I do El Diablo, or if it's the art. I don't know. I'm just not sure. But for whatever reason, I did enjoy the Killer Croc part of the story less than the El Diablo. That's not to say that the Killer Croc story wasn't entertaining. We got a little bit of an origin story for him, and then we see he's kind of much like Superman, which I'm going to talk about next. He turns out Killer Croc is on a monster island, and the story is really about humanity in a way. Like, how much of his humanity is left? How much is the monster taking over? Does he really want to fit in? Does he not? I guess in a way you could kind of compare him to Aquaman, in that he's torn between these two worlds. You know, he can go one of two ways. He can embrace his human side and try to do what good he can do on the Suicide Squad, or he can embrace the fact that he's a monster. He's you know, half reptile. He's inhuman, and just kind of suppress everything that of his humanity that remains, and just become the monster. So it's interesting that he's going to this island where, in a way, there are real monsters. And it may be that even though Killer Croc looks hideous, and maybe from the outside looking in, you would think that he kind of belongs on this island, really it could show him that he actually tried to be more human. I've never been more interested in Killer Croc, and that's a real credit to the writer of the story, who is Christopher Sabella. So I'm looking forward to reading more. Again, this whole book really, really surprised me. I wouldn't have thought that I would have enjoyed a book where the first half of the story was El Diablo and the second half was Killer Croc. I wouldn't have thought I would ever enjoy a book about these two characters so much. So let me mention real quick the Killer Croc part of the story. Drawn by artist Brian Level, and the colors are by Beth Sottolo. All right, up next we have Superman number 9, written by Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason. The pencils are by Doug Mankey. The inks are by Jaime Mendoza and Trevor Scott, and the colors are by Will Quintana. So this is continuing the Dinosaur Island arc, which are I guess it's just two parts. I don't really call it an arc, but the Dinosaur Island story that started in Superman number 8. Superman and his son trapped on an island meets Captain Storm from the Losers. They end up taking out this crazy gorilla, and Superman and Clark end up returning home. That's basically the book in a nutshell. There's so much more to it than that. Love this version of the Losers. Love that Tomasi and Gleason have brought these characters, or at least Captain Storm, back into the fold of the DC Universe, had the courage to use them. It's really, really great. The art by Doug Mankey, you know, Mankey's art is always spectacular. Great compositions within panels, wonderful page layouts, great detail. Especially like the way he draws Captain Storm with the strong jawline, the eye patch. Yeah. Superman's great. Father-son dynamic, Dinosaur Island, in a way honoring Darwin Cook, an appearance by Captain Storm from the Losers. I mean, amazing. Just an amazing job. And again, Superman's one of those books that I look forward to reading every week when it comes out. It's just so, so, so good. I can't remember the last time the Superman family of books from top to bottom were this good. Just stunning. And like I said, the artwork by Mankey, absolutely beautiful. There's one image where Captain Storm's riding a pterodactyl, and right below him we see John riding on the back of his father, and then Crypto flying next to him. In the background, there's clouds, there's lightning. Just a gorgeous, gorgeous piece. So, yeah, really, really, really good issue of Superman this week. All right, and the last book I'm going to talk about is Trinity Number 2 by Francis Manapul. And when I say by Francis Manapul, I mean the story, the script, the art, the cover. And when I say art, that's pencils, that's inks, that's color. I mean, he just does an incredible job. If I had any complaint about this issue, it's a little hard to follow with what... There's a little bit of a jump between the end of issue 1 and issue 2. Probably will read better in the trade. Won't be... I felt like, did I miss something? Like, I thought I remembered what happened in issue 1. But it could just be a nature of what is affecting the Trinity that we find out at the end of the story. So, much like the Superman title, very heavy focus on family in this book. But Francis Manapul, man, his art is so amazing. There are times when I feel like I'm looking at a Norman Rockwell drawing. And that's exactly, I have a feeling, exactly what Manapul's going for. You know, it's that classic feel. It's that universally homely feel, like the classic Norman Rockwell drawings on the Saturday Evening Post. You know, there's something inherently innocent and beautiful and uniquely American about those images. So I feel like that's what Manapul is able to capture on the pages of the book. As far as his writing goes, the dialogue's a bit stilted at times. It's not the best. I think that will come with time. But as far as exactly what's going on in the story, we just don't really have enough information at this point. So the jury's still out on that, but it's such a gorgeous book. I mean, I'm definitely going to be picking up issue 3. So great job by Francis Manapul. Trinity, I'm loving the book. I'm loving the family feel. And I hope that at the end of it, that Wonder Woman and Batman can accept this Superman as the Superman and kind of call it the dogs, so to speak, as far as monitoring him, I guess you'd say. So those are the books for this week for the DC Rebirth. Real quick, I'll say my book of the week. It's a tough call. This time, you know, last week was kind of a no-brainer. This week, it's much, much tougher. And not because there was nothing good, but just because there were so many things that were at that same great level. But I think if I had to pick one, I'd probably go with Batman Number 9 by Tom King and Mikhail Yanin as my favorite book this week. A couple reasons for that. It's a great jumping-on point. We know that we've seen some Easter eggs in this issue that are going to play out in the future. Up to 3 storylines. I think Tom King said 3 important storylines or important plot points happen in the issue. So I imagine it's going to take a long time for all those things to play out. Plus, I've anxiously been awaiting Mikhail Yanin's art on Batman. And in that way, much like with the writing and the story itself, I was not let down one bit. So kudos to you both. Batman Number 9, my book of the week. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening. Please visit us at thecomicsourceblog.com for past episodes of the podcast. You can also watch episodes of our YouTube channel there, as well as finding Manny's written blog, my written blog, and of course our famous sketch gallery. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Also do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date on new episodes and convention coverage. We have a couple conventions coming up. Phoenix Fan Fest this weekend, followed by Stanley's Los Angeles Comic Con next weekend. So those are the shows we'll be at. Make sure you let us know if you're going to be there. You can come up and say hi. In the meantime, if there's any books you want us to review or think we should be reading, please don't hesitate to reach out and let us know all about it. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.